very big around the middle. Richard sees my open mouth and elbows me so I shut it before Anne sees. "She's going to have a baby," he whispers. I blush at my ignorance. I'm glad Richard warned me before I said something to embarrass her. The ships keep arriving. The rumor is that the Virginia Company is tired of sending a few colonists and having most of them die off, so they are sending a lot, and women too, so that even if many die, the colony will still survive. By summer's end, we have nearly 500 colonists to feed and house. We also have horses, cows, goats, sheep, more hogs, more chickens, and more dogs and cats. There is hardly room to step without landing on someone's foot, a squawking chicken, or a pile of cow dung. We cannot get the houses built fast enough, and we are crammed together almost the way we were on the tween deck of the Susan Constant. Arguments flare up nearly every day. The ships have also brought us back Captain Archer and Captain Ratcliffe. They make no secret of the fact that they hate Captain Smith and want to be rid of him. There is a new charter, they say, sent by the Virginia Company. The charter says instead of a president and a council, we'll have one governor to rule us. That governor is, for now, Sir Thomas Gates. Then, next year, Sir Thomas West, Lord de la War, will arrive to become our Lord Governor and Captain General. Sir Thomas Gates is on his way to Jamestown on the flagship, the Sea Venture.
"Step down from your office as president," they order Captain Smith.
Captain Smith demands to see this new charter. Captain Ratcliffe folds his arms over his chest.
"It is on the Sea Venture with Sir Thomas Gates," he says. "You will see it soon enough."
But the days go by, and the Sea Venture does not arrive. Captain Smith insists he is still our president. Now I see what it means that power is like weights in a balance, and when someone gains power, someone else loses power. This Sir Thomas Gates, our new governor, has gained power even though he is still somewhere out at sea. And so, Captain Smith has lost power. The new colonists do not respect him. When he tries to explain our delicate relationship with the Indians, how we trade and work to keep a fragile peace, they scoff at him.
"Those savages will understand the power in a musket. That's all they need to know," they say.
The day I see smoke rising over the treetops, I know something has gone terribly wrong. Two of the new settlers come straggling into the fort, dragging wooden clubs, their faces smudged with soot.
"Did you see that savage's expression when I lit up his house?"
one man asks the other. He makes a mock, terrified face and takes a few running steps, as if he is escaping something.
"Ha! And look at this,"
the other man says.
"I found it in a house with a bunch of bones, as if the dead men could take it all with them."
He pours out the contents of a sack. Necklaces of shiny beads, copper, and tiny, beautiful shells go scattering over the ground. I stare in horror. They have robbed the Indians' temples, taken the jewels from the bodies of their dead werowances, set their houses on fire.
"How many do you think we killed?"
one is asking the other, holding up his club and examining it. My legs go weak. The club is stained with blood. I don't stay to hear the answer, but run to Captain Smith's cabin. My throat is tight with rage, but I choke out the words. "The new settlers," I say. "They're killing and burning." Captain Smith marches to where the two men are still gloating, telling of their escapades to anyone who will listen. Captain Smith's glowering eyes silence the men at once. He demands to hear it all, and the men sheepishly give a full account. A group of our colonists have burned the natives' houses, stolen from their gardens, robbed valuables from their temples, beat the people with clubs, and shot them with muskets. The natives have become furious and killed some of our colonists, And so the Englishmen feel they have the right to do more killing and burning and stealing. I want to shout at them. How could they do this? They don't care that the natives have saved us from starvation over and over again. They don't care that Chief Powhatan himself saved us from freezing and hunger when all our houses burned. They have no hearts, only pride and a feeling that they are superior. They say the natives are savages, but in truth, these ignorant Englishmen are the savages. Captain Smith is as angry as I am.
Are you trying to start an all-out war with the natives?
He shouts.
With 10,000 of them and a few hundred of us? Are you insane?
I can see it in his eyes, the fury and the rage. He wants to punch something, beat someone's face in, punish the men who have done this. Then I see him do the same thing he did so long ago on the ship the day Master Wingfield ordered him arrested. He narrows his eyes. He must be focusing his anger, I think. He is devising a plan to try to change all of this.
I will go up the river and talk to the tribes these men have wronged, he says. I will work to make peace again. If I do not, it could be the end of our settlement.
Captain Smith gathers a few men to sail up river with him in the shallop. He chooses several men who have been here since the beginning. Then two of the new settlers, both gentlemen, tell him how much they want to help make peace with the Powhatans. They badger Captain Smith to take them along. Finally, he relents. I think these two gentlemen just want to get away from our crowded fort and go exploring. Then a new thought strikes me. What if they are not just bored young men who want an adventure? What if they are under the influence of Captain Ratcliffe, Captain Archer, and the others who hate Captain Smith? What if they plan to do him harm? The morning they leave, I watch the shallop sail away. There are six of them in the boat, and I am glad to see that three of the men are Captain Smith's trusted friends. Still, the uneasy feeling does not leave me.
Chapter 24. Sleeping in his boat, accidentally, someone fired his powder bag, which tore the flesh from his body and thighs 9 or 10 inches square in a most pitiful manner. But to quench the tormenting fire, frying him in his clothes, he leaped overboard into the deep river, where ere they could recover him, he was near drowned. William Simons, E.D. The Proceedings.
They say it was an accident, no one's fault. Captain Smith lay down in the boat to take a nap. He was still wearing his powder bag. While he slept, a spark must have lit the powder bag, a spark from someone's pipe, or from the slow match on someone's musket. The powder caught fire and exploded. It seared the flesh right off his leg. In agony, Captain Smith leaped overboard to cool the burn. His leg was so badly injured, and he was so weak that he nearly drowned before the men could pull him out. When Captain Smith comes back to us, he is crazed with pain, moaning in a delirium. Three men carry him into the fort. The flesh on his thigh is turned black and red, the skin hanging ragged and oozing. He is our fallen leader, and he has fallen all the way down. The doctor gives Captain Smith medicine to ease the terrible pain, and it makes him sleep most of the day. When he is awake, I bring him food and water. When the doctor changes his bandages, I give Captain Smith the handle of a wooden spoon to bite on so that he can endure the pain. I am surprised he has not bitten through the wood yet. It is awful to see him in so much agony. I wash his bandages, rinsing out the blood and ooze, and hang them to dry. One of the soldiers tells me that before he was injured, Captain Smith was able to make peace with Parahunt, the werowance of a village that has been ransacked by our colonists. But, the soldier confides in me, The peace cannot last. There has been too much killing on both sides, and everyone is too angry. One day I bring Captain Smith a drink of water. As I help him to sit up, he goes pale and beads of sweat break out on his face. I keep hold of the goblet in case he blacks out.
"They have cut off my hands and cut out my tongue,"
he says in a hoarse whisper. I shake my head. I don't know if he is fully awake or in a delirium. I want to tell him he still has his hands and tongue. But, sir...
"Go get Richard,"
he says. I run down to the river where Richard is repairing fish nets. "Richard!" I call out. "Come, quickly!" He splashes through the water to meet me. I'm panting, out of breath.
"What is it? Is it Captain Smith?" he asks.
"Yes, I mean no. He has not died. He is saying strange things. He asked for you." We both run up the river bank to the fort. We enter the cabin quietly. "Sir, we are both here, me and Richard," I say.
"Good,"
he says without opening his eyes. He takes a deep breath, as if he is gathering his strength.
"They have taken away my power here,"
he says.
"I can no longer use my hands and my words to help the colony. There is nothing more I can do. I will return to England."
His words hit me like a punch in the stomach. "Return to England?"
"Richard,"
he says, and Richard stands up straighter.
"You will accompany me to England. I saw how you cared for Reverend Hunt in his illness, and I know you will do the same for me. We will leave with the next departing ship." "Samuel,"
he says. He opens his eyes and turns his head to look at me.
"You are one of the few original settlers left alive. I chose you for a reason. I knew how hard it would be here in the New World, and that only the toughest and strongest would survive. Reverend Hunt told me you were a fighter, full of anger and energy. I knew you would make a good settler, and you have. You will be fine here without me. You have your skills, building, farming, hunting, and you have your Algonquin language. You will stay because the colony needs you. I release you from your servitude."
I am too stunned to speak. I feel as though I have been dropped from a great height and have landed on my feet. But I don't know where I am. "But I am your page," I say softly. "Who will I be without my master?" Captain Smith shakes his head and continues.
"To make sure no gentleman decides to grab you up as his servant, I have apprenticed you to John Leyden. You will become a carpenter in your own right."
I am filled with both sadness and wonder. Reverend Hunt was right. I will not always be a servant. But Captain Smith and Richard both leaving me at the same time? It seems as if I have finally learned to be a friend, to open my heart and care. And now they will both be gone when the ships sail. I take a deep, shuddery breath. "Yes, sir," I say. It is the only thing I can think of to say. In the weeks before the ships are ready to leave, it is time to bring in the harvest, gather oysters, and bring in hauls of fish and meat, and smoke it all so that it will last the winter. But without Captain Smith to lead us, the men shirk their work. And the gentlemen seem to have but one purpose in life, to make sure Captain Smith goes back to England as a man accused of many wrongs, rather than a hero who saved our colony from extinction. They spend their time gathered in meetings, making lists of accusations against him. They do not even realize that Captain Smith's last act, making peace with Parahunt, has saved their skins, for now. I feel as though there is a noose closing in around Jamestown, ready to strangle all of us here. Chief Powhatan is angry about the coronation fiasco. The new settlers have attacked Indian villages and made enemies where we used to have friends. We have too many settlers to feed, and yet hardly anyone is working to store food for the winter. And we are about to lose Captain Smith. I can see why Captain Smith wants to take Richard with him. Truly, only the strongest and toughest will survive what is coming. I wonder if I have what it takes. There is one bright spot in all of this. Anne Leyden will soon have her baby. She is very happy to have other women here now, including a midwife, and children to hold and admire as she waits for her very own to arrive. It will be the first child born in our colony. Anne says if it is a girl, they will name her Virginia. I have learned something important from Reverend Hunt. When I lose someone, I should not close my heart to everyone, but should find someone else to fill the empty place. Captain Smith and Richard will soon leave, but I will still have my friends living nearby. Namuntak, Cainta, and Pocahontas. And here in Jamestown, Anne and John Leyden are becoming like my new family. When their baby arrives, he or she will be like my little brother or sister.
Get the midwife! Now, quickly!
A large woman, barely done tying her apron strings, goes running to the cabin John and Anne Leyden share with two other families. The men and children are ushered out, and we begin the long wait. John Leyden paces, his face a mask of worry. She'll be all right, I tell him, but I know that birthing kills so many women and babies that John has reason to worry. The hours tick by. I go off to chop some wood, then come back and wait with John. We hear screams from the cabin, and crying out in the pain of childbirth. Finally, we hear the lusty wail of a newborn baby. John runs to the door of his cabin and pounds on it.
"Let me in!"
he demands.
"You wait," the midwife calls back to him, "and then you can see your baby girl."
John laughs and cries at the same time.
"It's a girl," he exclaims. "The baby is alive and it's a girl."
Then his face darkens and he pounds on the door again.
"And what about my wife?" he shouts. "Is she well?"
"Yes, yes. She was brave and she is well," the midwife announces.
John groans with relief.
"They're both alive,"
he says, almost incredulous.
"My wife and my baby girl."
A few weeks later, I am one of the first people Anne allows to hold baby Virginia. She is so tiny, so delicate. Her eyes move, looking at the ceiling above me, and she smiles sweetly, as if she is seeing angels. Anne says she's just making faces because she has gas. I offer Virginia my finger. She grasps it and holds tight. As I look at her, I feel sad. I feel the coming doom. How will she survive the hard times that will soon be upon us? Virginia blows bubbles and grasps my finger even tighter. "You must hold on this tightly to life," I whisper to her.
Chapter 25. What shall I say? But thus we lost him, that in all his proceedings may justice his first guide, and experience his second. Ever hating baseness, sloth, pride, and indignity, more than any dangers, that never allowed more for himself than his soldiers with him, that upon no danger would send them where he would not lead them himself, that would never see us want what either he had or could by any means get us, whose adventures were our lives, and whose loss our deaths. William Simons, E.D. The Proceedings.
The day the ships are to leave, I go to Captain Smith's cabin to help him gather his belongings. He is able to take a few painful steps with the cane now, but it is still hard for him to get around. Everyone says he is returning to England to get better medicine than we have here. But I know he would stay if they had not robbed him of his authority and his power to help our colony. Captain Smith holds two strings of beads in his hand. They are a new kind, blue, with intricate designs made by layers in the glass. They are worth a fortune in trading, because the Indians prize them so much. He looks at the beads sadly.
"I will not need these for now,"
he says. He holds them out for me to take.
"Use them to trade this winter, when the hunger sets in."
I am stunned. I have never before touched these New World diamonds. As a servant, I did not feel I had the right to. Now I am no longer a servant. Slowly, I take the beads from him. They feel cold and smooth in my hand. I tuck them into the buckskin carrying pouch hanging at my waist. Captain Smith looks at me hard.
"Samuel, it will not be easy here. Things will happen that will make you angry, but do not let your anger get the best of you. Channel it. Let it give you strength for what you can do to change things, to make things better. Do you understand?"
I nod. I've watched him do this over and over, this shifting of anger into calm action. "I understand," I tell him. He looks around the cabin, as if he is wanting to remember it always. My throat is tight with tears, but I will not let them fall. I remember the first time I saw Captain Smith on the docks at Blackwall, how strong and brash he seemed. I remember how I hated the idea of serving him and learning from him. Then I think of how much I have learned from him, how much I have changed because of him. I search for the right words to say what I feel, but I can't find them. "I am sorry to see you go, sir," I say finally. Captain Smith stands a little straighter.
"I'll be back,"
he assures me.
"I am not done with Jamestown yet."
Then he does something that surprises me almost as much as the beads. He reaches out his hand to shake mine, as if I am his equal, as if I am a man. His hand is leathery and calloused from the hard work he has done here. So is mine, I suppose. We shake hands heartily. "Have a good voyage, sir," I say. We begin the slow, painful walk to the ships, him with his cane and me carrying a sack of his belongings.
"I want to find you alive and well when I return, Samuel,"
he says good-naturedly.
"No starving, no dying from the summer sickness, no getting shot full of arrows."
I grin. "Yes, sir," I say. His orders suit me just fine. John Leyden joins us and gives Captain Smith a strong shoulder to lean on as he struggles to walk.
"You have been a just leader, Captain," he says. "What will we do without you?" "You experienced settlers know a thing or two about survival,"
Captain Smith says.
"Maybe these newcomers will learn from you."
Others join us until we are a small knot of men walking slowly out the fort gates and down to the river. The men each have something to say.
"You were the best president we ever had, sir. You did more work than any of those gentlemen."
"Who will trade with the natives with you gone, sir?"
"Have a safe journey, Captain Smith."
The longboats are already making their trips back and forth to the motherships. Richard is there waiting for his turn. He was still asleep when I left the cabin this morning, so this is the first I've had a chance to talk to him. "Samuel," he calls to me as I approach, "are you sure you don't want to come? Think of all you're missing. The seasickness, the rats, the storms, week after week in the nice dark tween deck." I take a deep breath, as if I am savouring my memory of the journey. Ah, the stench, and the way the slop bucket sloshed all over the place in rough seas. I touch my hand to my heart. I will miss it. Richard laughs. Maybe you should come back with us, he says. You can be an actor in one of Master Shakespeare's new plays. There are plenty of good things I can think of about England. Fields of heather blooming in the countryside, London's busy, exciting streets, the chance to visit my mum's grave. But I will stay here, in Jamestown. I touch the beads through the soft buckskin of my carrying pouch. I suppose you'll miss me terribly too, I say to Richard, continuing the foolery. Who will you have fistfights with if I'm not there? He crosses his arms over his chest, and we just look at each other. The truth is, I will miss him terribly.
Richard, get yourself in that longboat or you're staying here,
Henry shouts. He is helping with the launch, and he has no patience. There is no time for long goodbyes. I ball up my fist and tap my chest, then my forehead, then Richard's chest and his forehead. Goodbye, friend, I say. Captain Smith and Richard ride the longboat to the ship. It is not easy for Captain Smith to climb the rope ladder to the deck, but Richard and some of the sailors help him, and he makes it. They turn for one last look at the Virginia shoreline, and our fort, and the group of us waving to them. Then they are ushered below to the tween deck for the long journey home. Soon after Captain Smith leaves, it is clear that we don't have nearly enough food to get us through the winter. When Chief Powhatan sends word that he will trade for corn, Captain Ratcliffe goes strutting around the fort, full of his own importance.
I will take 50 men, he announces. We have piles of copper and beads, and will bring back plenty of corn to feed everyone. Captain Smith was not the only man skilled in trading. You will see how quickly we forget he was ever here.
The new colonists are happy. They trust Captain Ratcliffe, and they feel confident we'll be eating well all winter. But I still see that noose, ready to strangle our colony. Then something happens that does give me hope. Hope for me and John Leyden and his family. Master Percy says we will build a fort at Point Comfort, about 30 miles downriver from Jamestown, near where the river meets the Chesapeake Bay. From there we will be able to protect Jamestown from a Spanish invasion. We'll stop the Spanish ships before they even enter the river. Soldiers will work to pile up dirt and mount artillery. John Leyden and I are being sent to build cabins for the fort. We will call our fort Algernon. I fear what will happen in Jamestown this winter, with its overcrowding and lack of food, and Jamestown is the heart of our colony. I believe that if the natives attack, it is Jamestown they will attack, but at Point Comfort we will only have about 30 men to feed. We'll have our own hogs, fish to catch, and oysters to dig. We will be just across the river from the Warriscoyac village, where the people have become like my family, and very near the Kecoughtans, who have been our friends because Captain Smith often stopped in to see them on his voyages. I have the blue beads and my Algonquin words. I will be very glad to spend the winter at Point Comfort instead of Jamestown. I happily gather up my belongings for the move to Point Comfort. Then I go to the Leyden's cabin to offer to help them pack. When I enter their cabin, John is packing up his carpentry tools. Anne is sitting quietly watching him while baby Virginia sleeps in her cradle. Are you already packed? I ask Anne. She looks down and shakes her head. John doesn't even glance at me. I frown. Why not? I ask. The barge will leave tomorrow morning.
She isn't coming, John says quietly.
What? I blurt out. But you have to come. No, I do not, Anne informs me. I finally have lots of other women here to talk to and help me with the baby. And I want to stay safe within the palisades, not out there in the open, unprotected from the Indians.
John will come to visit me whenever he can. I will stay here in Jamestown. I sputter, not believing what I'm hearing. It is much safer at Point Comfort, I tell her. Our neighbors are the Cacoftons, our friends, and the Werris Koyaks. I know everyone in the village by name. I can trade if we run short of food. Anne shakes her head. I have made up my mind, she says. You won't be safe within the palisade, I insist. The new settlers have made war with the Powhatans. John, tell her what it was like when we first got here, how we couldn't even step outside the palisade to hunt without being shot at, and men starved. John stops working for a moment.
I told her, he says. She is stubborn and knows what she wants.
Then order her to leave Jamestown, I nearly shout it. John looks up at me, one eyebrow raised. I realize that I have said a stupid thing. It is not in his nature to order his wife to do something against her will.
She wants to stay with the other women, he says. I won't take that away from her.
Anne crosses her arms over her chest and gives me a self-satisfied look. Besides, she says, our leaders are not at war with the Powhatans. Chief Powhatan just invited Captain Ratcliffe to come to Werowocomoco to trade. They will have a feast and entertain them with dances, just like you told me about. And they'll come back with lots of corn. We will have all we need to eat in Jamestown this winter. We won't even have to go out of the palisade. I want to grab her and shake her, shout into her face. There is no safety in Jamestown. I am seething with anger. Why can't they see? Why won't they listen to me? I want to punch something. I ball up my fist, ready to slug the wall. Then an image flashes in my mind of Captain Smith ready to lose control of his anger. Then of him taking a deep breath, focusing, calming, devising a plan. I hear Captain Smith's voice in my head.
Samuel, do not let your anger get the best of you. Channel it. Let it give you strength to change things.
I take a breath, try to calm the fury inside me. I walk over to the cradle where baby Virginia is sleeping. She is wrapped in a blanket, her eyes fluttering in sleep, her little mouth making sucking motions. She is so new, so innocent. I look at Anne. She is young and innocent, too, only 15, and she is naive. She trusts Captain Ratcliffe to keep her safe and fed. Suddenly, it is Reverend Hunt's voice I hear in my head.
You must learn to make decisions out of love, not out of fear.
I take another deep breath. My anger is focused. I have made a decision. I have a plan. I believe Reverend Hunt would approve. I have made this decision out of love. I am about to steal a baby. Chapter 26.
Good men did never their country's ruin bring, but when evil men shall injuries begin, not caring to corrupt and violate the judgment seats for their own lucre's sake, then look, that country cannot long have peace, though for the present it have rest and ease. William Simons, E.D. The Proceedings.
The next morning I am ready. My canoe nestled in the rushes has a bed of blankets, a jar of sweetened water, a clean rag, and a spoon for the baby, and a piece of bread saved from last night's supper for me. I go to Anne and John's cabin. Anne is busy wrapping up dried beef and bread for John, and John is trying to comfort a fussy Virginia. Let me take her for a walk in the fresh air, I say. Then you two can have some time together before the barge leaves.
John gladly hands Virginia to me. Anne ties Virginia's tiny bonnet on her and tells me to make sure I support her head. I promise that I will. The fort is swarming with people. I walk by the crowds out of the gates and just keep on going. I know there will be people outside the fort as well, so that my message will get back to Anne. At the canoe, I am in luck. Two little girls are washing clothes in the river.
"Ooh, can we see Miss Layden's baby?"
one asks. I tilt Virginia down so they can admire her, being careful to support her head. "I am going to Point Comfort," I tell the girls as I climb into the canoe. "Mrs. Layden will meet me there." I imagine the ruckus when Anne discovers Virginia missing, and that these two girls will be in the middle of it, crying out in their high voices that they saw me and I said I was going to Point Comfort. I will have a head start by then, but I am sure that Anne will be on her way, following me. That is what I am counting on, that she will be on that barge with her husband. It will take hours to get to Point Comfort, but in my canoe I will be quicker than the barge, even with breaks to feed the child. Virginia settles nicely on her bed of blankets and falls asleep as the canoe rocks in the water. I paddle out into the middle of the river, where a bit of current will speed me on my way. The trees on the shores have just begun to turn their autumn colours. The day is clear and warm, with a gentle wind. I have no fear of a storm blowing up to capsize us. 3 times I stop paddling when Virginia fusses to be fed. I spoon the sweetened water into her mouth. Then I dip the clean rag into the sweet water, give it to her to suck on, and she goes back to sleep. It is something I saw my mum do when she took care of a baby, whose mother had died, until she could find a wet nurse. It is late afternoon when we make it to the fort. I pull the canoe up on shore. Nathaniel is on watch along with another soldier, who is sound asleep. As I carry Virginia toward him, Nathaniel stares at me, open-mouthed. "Don't ask," I tell him. "I'll explain later, but please, can I put her in your tent?" Nathaniel shakes his head.
"I have to report you to Captain Davies, my commanding officer," he says.
I groan. "My meat ration for a month," I offer him. His face lights up, and he leads me to his tent. I feed Virginia one more time and lay her down on a straw bed to sleep. She has wet through her blanket. I forgot all about diapers. Then I go out to the waterfront to wait for the barge to arrive. I knew she would be angry, furious even. I am not prepared for Anne's rage when she arrives at Point Comfort.
"I'll kill you!"
Anne shrieks. She runs at me, her hands raised. I try to grab her wrists, but she is too wild. Her fingernails rake my face. I feel stinging pain, see my blood drip.
"Let me explain," I shout, but she is screaming too loudly to hear me. "Thief! Murderer! Hang him!"
she yells. John disembarks as well.
"Are you mad?"
he shouts. He cuffs me hard.
"You deserve to be hanged."
I start to panic. I have stolen a child. Will they hang me? "But she is safe," I say. "I did it to keep her safe." Captain Davies takes me roughly by the arm.
"Don't worry, Mrs. Layden," he says. "He will be punished."
Anne is sobbing now.
"Where is she?"
she demands. I see Nathaniel looking terrified. He does not want to be part of this. "I put her in Nathaniel's tent," I say quickly. That is all they need to know. I am dragged off by Captain Davies as Anne runs to find her baby. It is a makeshift brig, but it does the job. Shackles on my wrists and ankles do not allow me to move much. There is no window, just cracks between the rough boards that let me know when the sun has set. I am left with a little water and the cold dirt floor to sleep on. For theft of the child, Virginia. What will my sentence be? Hanging?
Whipping? I have seen whippings where, at the end, they are flogging a corpse. Captain Smith said he wanted me alive and well when he returned to Jamestown. I may not be able to follow through on my promise. The worst of it is that I have failed. This has all been for nothing. Anne and Virginia will return to Jamestown tomorrow with the barge. Since this may be my last night on earth, I try to make my peace with God. I am sorry, I tell him. Sorry that I failed with James, and that now I have failed with Anne and Virginia. I hope that at least he understands that I meant no harm in stealing Virginia. I ask to please be taken up to heaven with my mum. In the dark I huddle on the floor and wish for the peace of sleep.
Captain Davies!
The shout wakes me. It comes from the river. Morning light slants into my cell. I hear clumsy paddle strokes and realize someone must be approaching in a canoe.
Get Captain Davies! Now!
The shout is closer. I hear footsteps, voices, someone out of breath.
It was a trap!
The man cries. The voices come nearer to my jail cell. I press my ear against the wall, hoping to hear.
Captain Ratcliffe and his men. Only a few have escaped.
I listen as he describes the horror. The men were lured to Werowocomoco with promises of corn. Instead, they were attacked, their throats slit. Captain Ratcliffe's end was even worse. He was tortured to death. I crouch against the wall, straining to hear, but the voices fade as the men walk away. I shake my head in despair. More men dead, and no corn brought back to Jamestown. A sound startles me, the scraping of the lock on the brig door. I get to my feet. It is time to face my sentence, end my punishment.
Chapter 27 Powhatan thus invited Captain Ratcliffe and 30 others to trade for corn, and having brought them within his ambush, murdered them. William White, The Black Boy's Ceremony.
Point Comfort, February, 1610. Snow falls, fine as sugar, but inside our cabin it is toasty warm. I'm about to get scalded, as usual.
Samuel, what are you doing?
Anne stands with her hands on her hips.
I'm hiding, I say simply. Watch, she likes it when I pop my head out.
I drop the handkerchief, and Virginia erupts with giggles. Anne shakes her head, but she is smiling. I hide again. Virginia crawls to me, grabs the handkerchief, and pulls it away. She is so pleased with herself, she laughs and claps her hands.
Samuel, stop your playing and come help me, Anne says.
She needs more firewood. I do not hesitate, but jump up to do as she bids. I owe my life to her. After she heard what happened to Captain Ratcliffe, Anne begged Captain Davies to retract my sentence. I don't know if I'd have survived the 20 lashes that were to be my punishment. Anne testified that I had done the right thing to convince her to be with her husband at Point Comfort. John, too, spoke up for me. He said I had meant well taking Virginia with me, and that he could not afford to lose his best apprentice. I owe my life to both of them. I step outside, leaving the warmth of our cabin. The air is crisp and sharp and smells of wood smoke. Snow swirls, coating the tree branches and giving everything a hushed feel. I am wearing my moccasins, and so I walk lightly through the snow, quiet as Cainter taught me to be. I smile when I think of Cainter. When the river thaws, I will paddle across to visit him in the Werowocomoco village and trade for corn. In the meantime, the Cacoftons are very close by, and my blue beads have kept us well supplied with corn from them. I go to the lean-to that protects our firewood from rain and snow, and stack the heavy pieces of wood in my arms. I feel strong. I am strong. I look around at the cabins that house our Fort Algernon soldiers. I help to build every one of them. Snow blows into my face and stings my cheeks, but I am warm. An image flashes in my mind of another wintry day. What seems like a lifetime ago, of me and Richard blowing on embers in a cold cabin, trying to coax up a fire. I feel a pang of missing him, and of missing Captain Smith, too, and Reverend Hunt. Then my mind goes back further still, to a small fire and a friendly hearth, and my mum bent over a pot, stirring. I'm doing all right, Mum. I send the words up to heaven to her. I'm living with a family, with people I love. And we have food and fire. The wind is blowing from the northwest, from Jamestown. I wonder if I can smell the smoke of their wood fires, more than 30 miles away, or if it is only our fort's fires I am smelling. The river has been frozen for many weeks now, and we have not heard from them. Are they as warm and well-fed as we are, I wonder? A sudden chill makes me shiver. I feel it like a splash of cold water, that old sense of doom and dread, the fear that made me desperate enough to snatch baby Virginia away. I shake it off quickly. No sense worrying about Jamestown now. I have my duties here, and we are safe here. Safe. The word settles on me like peace. Anne, John, and Virginia are here with me, and we are safe. I load my arms with a few more pieces of wood, then turn and walk back through the snow to our cabin.
Afterward. Now all of us at Jamestown beginning to feel that sharp prick of hunger, which no man truly describe, but he which hath tasted the bitterness thereof. All was fish that came to net to satisfy cruel hunger, as to eat boots, shoes, or any other leather some could come by. And now famine beginning to look ghastly and pale in every face, that nothing was spared to maintain life, and to do those things which seem incredible, as to dig up dead corpses out of graves and to eat them. George Percy, The True Relation of the Proceedings and Occurrence. During the winter of 1609 to 1610, the settlers at Point Comfort did not go hungry. They had enough extra fish and crabs that even their hogs were well fed. As winter set in, ice formed on the river, and travel between Jamestown and Point Comfort became impossible. It was not until spring that those at Point Comfort found out about the horror that befell Jamestown that winter. Chief Powhatan ordered his tribes to stop trading with the settlers at Jamestown. The natives also went to Hog Island, which the settlers had stocked with hundreds of hogs, and slaughtered them all. Then they went back to killing any settler they found outside the fort. Settlers were afraid to hunt and fish, so they remained inside the palisades. When the stores ran out, and they'd eaten the last of their sheep and goats, they ate even the laying hens. As things got worse, they ate their horses, dogs, and cats, and then any rat, mouse, or snake they could catch. When there was nothing left to kill, they even ate their starch collars, their leather shoes, anything that could be chewed and swallowed. Men, women, and children starved and died. Hunger caused desperation. Some of the colonists began to dig up the dead bodies and eat them. One group of men escaped that terrible winter by using violence to secure a large quantity of food from one of the native tribes, and then stealing one of the ships and sailing back to England. The remaining settlers were ravaged by disease, starvation, and warfare with the Indians. Out of the roughly 500 settlers Captain Smith said were in Jamestown when he left, By spring, only 60 settlers remained, all of them close to death. The winter of 1609 to 1610 became known as the Starving Time. Chief Powhatan had tried again to wipe out the tribe that came from the Chesapeake, and he had nearly succeeded. In the spring of 1610, the man who was to be Jamestown's new governor in 1609, Sir Thomas Gates, finally arrived. He had been shipwrecked on Bermuda for 9 months until new ships could be built from the remains of the Sea Venture. When Gates saw the desperate conditions in Jamestown, he decided to abandon the settlement and take the remaining survivors back to England. But as they sailed down the river, heading home, they were met by a messenger carrying a letter. It said that Sir Thomas West, Lord de la Warr, the new Lord Governor and Captain General of Jamestown, was on his way up the river to Jamestown with 3 ships, over 150 new colonists, and food for a year. The message was clear: go back to Jamestown. Reluctantly, the settlers returned to try again. The next several years were difficult ones. Jamestown's new leaders took revenge on the natives, even the Cacoftons and the Warriscoyacs, who had helped the settlers so much. They slaughtered native men, women, and even children from many tribes. Revenge bred revenge, and there were raids and killing on both sides. In 1613, Pocahontas was kidnapped by the settlers and held hostage. In return for her freedom, they demanded that her father free the English prisoners he was holding, give back stolen English weapons and tools, and send a large quantity of corn. Chief Powhatan gave the settlers some of what they asked for, saying he would send the rest when his daughter was returned to him. The English said this was not enough. Chief Powhatan refused to give in to the hostage-takers' demands, and Pocahontas remained a prisoner. John Rolfe, a new colonist, began growing tobacco in Jamestown. Tobacco grew well in Virginia and sold well in England, and finally there was hope that the colony would make a profit for the Virginia Company of London. While she was held prisoner, Pocahontas met John Rolfe. The two were married in 1614 with Chief Powhatan's blessing. This began a period of time some historians call the Peace of Pocahontas. For a while, there was not as much bloodshed between the English and the natives, and the two groups shared the land together. Pocahontas, her husband John Rolfe, and their son Thomas were taken to England by Sir Thomas Dale to promote the Jamestown colony and help Dale get financial assistance. There she became ill and died in 1617. She was buried at St. George's Parish Church in Gravesend, England. In 1619, the first Africans arrived in the Virginia colony on a privateering ship. It is not clear whether they were slaves or indentured servants, which means they would have to work for a number of years, and then they would be free. But soon, especially with so much labor needed for the tobacco fields, Africans were brought to Virginia and sold as slaves for life. Was Reverend Hunt's prediction right? Did Samuel become something much greater than a servant? Yes. In 1619, the Virginia Company of London created the House of Burgesses in Virginia. By that time, there were 11 settlements, and each settlement had its own leadership. Samuel Collier, by then a grown man, was recognized for his knowledge, skills, and ability to communicate with the natives in their own language. Captain Smith wrote that Samuel was appointed leader of a town. Captain John Smith was never able to return to Jamestown, but his writings are one of our most valuable records of what went on in the colony. Did the Powhatan prophecy ever reach its conclusion? In 1622, though Chief Powhatan had died, his empire was still strong, led by his brother, Opechancanough. There were still many more natives than Europeans living in Virginia, but more settlers arrived on ships from England every couple of months, and they were taking over more and more of the land the Indians used for hunting and planting. Chief Opechancanough decided to wipe out the English once and for all. He carefully planned his attack. On March 22, 1622, 347 colonists were killed, about one-third of the Virginia European population. The settlers began raiding the Indian villages, killing and burning, with the goal of exterminating the native people. War between the natives and the Europeans continued for years. Chief Opechancanough did mount one more large attack on the settlers in 1644, but by then the European population had grown and the Indian population had been decimated. Chief Opechancanough was captured and killed, and the Powhatan Empire crumbled. Just as the prophecy had predicted, the Powhatan Empire was destroyed by a new tribe that arrived from the Chesapeake Bay. During the first 100 years after the English arrived in 1607, over 90% of Virginia's native population was killed either in warfare and massacres or by the new diseases the Europeans brought with them. As Europeans took over more and more of their land, the natives were forced onto reservations, and then over time most of their reservation land was taken from them. There is, however, land in the Virginia countryside that, for thousands of years, has been home to the native peoples who still live there.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Blood on the River, Jamestown, 1607, by Eliza Carbone. Read by Brian Kennedy. Text copyright 2006 by Eliza Carbone. Production copyright 2008, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.